Okay. Maybe we can start with you just introducing yourself.
I'm Charity Hicks. I'm Policy Director for East Michigan Environmental Action Council, and I'm an Equitable Food and Agricultural Fellow for the E4Health program. And I live in Detroit.
Well, let's start with some broad questions. Mm-hmm. So you talk a lot about food sovereignty. Mm-hmm. And for those that don't know what is it and why is it necessary?
Food sovereignty, in its most basic sense, is the people's democratic control over the food system. So it has frames around working with nature, democratically controlled, restores the relationship with people in their food system. And so food sovereignty represents a frame and a process and a belief around food and agriculture based upon human rights and human dignity and democracy.
How did you get involved with pretty much everything that you do now? I don't even know how to list it all.
I come out of clinical research work, health disparity research from University of Michigan. And one of the things that I see that a lot of things are connected together. And so it's hard for you to focus in the drill down when food and climate are connected or when the environment connects and intersects with food. And so it was a natural progression to think about how climate right now is impacting every element of my work. So environmental justice is impacted by climate. My food system work is impacted by climate. And so there's a broad interaction across all these areas of work, including water, including economic development, which is impacted by climate. And so all these things, to me, I see as one whole system, and they're all nested together. And if you touch one, you have to be aware of how you're also touching the other aspects.
So how has climate and all of its related consequences affected Detroit specifically?
Climate has affected Detroit because, one, with the temperature rise, we get quite a number of days where we're past 100. And this creates, in an urban environment under heat island effect, profound, like, heat indexes that promote heat stroke and heat exhaustion and exacerbates a public health profile on the community. So Detroit, under hot, hot weather, it shuts down the city. And it creates a profound health impact. And work, if you work outdoors, it creates inversions in the climate. So you get a lot of pollution in the environment, these ozone action days, where if you have asthma or respiratory issues, that your health is complicated on those days. Another thing, the way climate is impacting Detroit is with severe and intense storms that literally lay down our infrastructure. So after these real intense storms, for 3-4 days, we'll have tens of thousands of people with no electricity. And so there's an infrastructure cost, there's a quality of life cost. And the third reason climate is impacting us is that these storms, as they race across America, they're dumping profound amount of water. And so we have a lot of regional flooding. So there's an infrastructure and an actual personal cost of flooding and property loss and property damage. And so climate becomes highly impactful for urban communities, and particularly Detroit.
This is something that you mentioned to me on Tuesday when we first met. You said that Anthony Bourdain had just visited Detroit and that he called Detroit the Pompeii of North America. Is that correct? As a community organizer in Detroit and as a Detroit native, can you comment on this remark? What's your response to Anthony Bourdain?
Well, what he was trying to appreciate and to share with his viewers is this thing about ruin porn. So Detroit has a great number of buildings and structures and facilities that are abandoned, and they jar you. And so he's trying to equate Detroit with Greek and Roman ruins so that people can appreciate, like, yeah, you go to the necropolis or these ancient Roman or Greek ruins. And I'm in Detroit, and I'm looking at ruins. And so it's pretty shocking. Even though Pompeii and the volcano that incinerated that community and like froze them in time and in motion, he was trying to think about how tourists would see things. To some degree, it's disaster tourism, right? We like to go to disaster sites or we like to go to ruins. And so he's appealing to that aesthetic. But he was also trying to show Detroit's resilience in food culture. He's a travel person. He's a foodie. He didn't really show Detroit in its authentic nature. He found all these white guys. And Detroit is almost 90% African-American. And a more authentic person would have been a black woman who carries the majority. And so it was kind of like a perpetuation of a narrative around who's the leadership and who's the authority in Detroit, but at the same time, like, ignoring who's actually there, who, like, lives there. And for the African-American community, we are not ghosts, you know? So even calling it Pompeii, what are you saying? We're incinerated by a volcano? We're ghosts? We're caricatures? We're, like, shadow people? We're, like, what are you really saying? But he also fell in love with Detroit. He claimed that Detroit was MF in Detroit, and Detroit looks like no other city because Detroit looks like Detroit. But there is this fascination with Detroit, particularly because of the municipal bankruptcy, the largest in North America and the United States, and also the economic decline and the displacement and dislocation of tens of thousands of people and the population loss. And it's kind of like, look at this modern American city. Look at it. So it's disaster tourism. It's a little bit voyeuristic, kind of like rubbernecking, looking at disasters, financial and social disasters. But there's a profound brilliance and beauty and love and euphoria in Detroit, in the community, in our social relationships, that was hard to capture from his program.
I hear you talk a lot about the importance of a narrative in terms of community organizing and in terms of finding solutions to problems. Can you elaborate more on why narratives are so important to us today?
Narratives become the place of our archetypal understanding. Narratives seek myth. Narratives carry values. Narratives carry our mythic space. So we each have an identity, cultural and socially and rooted in relationships. And so narrative is a place for it to live. And so narratives become critical to not only conveying information, but they also become critical in showing hierarchy and racism and just things that are out of order. They also become the place for policymaking. The narratives that we tell ourselves represent kind of like our values and our principles. You know, the things we value, when you hear the narrative, you're like, okay, you value that. Because the language, the relationship inside of the language and the story, that narrative, will demonstrate this is a value. The principles you carry, your narrative will say, these are my principles. And so policymaking becomes our collective space of grounding our values and principles and the lived experience of our stories. The stories of our place, of our geography, the stories of our communities, and the stories of our human community. And narratives become critical. And so for people that are in First Nations and Indigenous communities, stories not only convey culture, they convey power. They recalibrate our rootedness, like how we feel about ourselves. And so when people are marginalized and abused, you could actually see it in a narrative. Like, you can read newspaper clippings, you can see journalistic things, and you can see marginalizing language. You can see languages that's describing things in a negative fashion. And narrative also is the place where we ship those values and principles out. Nobody shows up and was like, let me transmit to you my values and my principles. No, they sit in narratives. And the more skillful we are in hearing and unpacking and examining narratives, the more we will be able to have a root cause analysis for things we're trying to change.
So a lot of the issues that are happening in climate and in food justice are highly structural and embedded in existing institutions. This is a two-part question. One, do you think that we can really affect meaningful change within the system, or does it have to be outside of it? And also, do you think the fact that Detroit, or at least as it's perceived in the media, is sort of breaking down institutionally but building a lot from the ground up puts it in a very advantageous place to affect real change?
I believe in both and not either or. So system change, if it's truly transformational, has to come from, one, a root cause analysis. You have to be, again, to not just to work on a superficial level of, like, symptoms that are coming off of a problem, but attacking the problem at its root. What is the precursor of it? Where is it being rooted at the tip of it? So inside of systems, you need people operating inside of systems with a particular analysis, trying to transform it internally. But you also need factors and people and folk and social movements external, bringing external pressure. The place of systems and institutions becomes almost a frame of policy work, right? This kind of top-down, this consensus building, is kind of like what's driving our processes and funding and social budgets. But also you need groundswells and tipping points. You need masses of people in social movements bringing externalized pressure. The two become critical. The problem is the strategy and the tactics that are employed to coordinate them all, and the analysis that's resting the internal work and the external work. So, yes, systems can be changed from inside and outside, and the best, most potent, transformative models should employ both. And you shouldn't put all your eggs in one basket. You shouldn't just be all inside, because you definitely would be twisted and distorted. And you can't just be outside, because then you need access and you need what we call insider knowledge. Both those frames are equally important. Detroit can be a model of transformation. No other city is confronted with the economic, social, political, and even environmental factors of like Detroit. So in Detroit, we get to experiment. We get to reimagine our social systems, our economic systems, our built environment, and our ecology. The moment of collapse and the moment of crisis provides profound opportunity. So the shifting has to be intentional. It can't just be organic. You can't just like, oh, we collapse and then wake up and says, oh, we'll go out and catch fish. Like, you have to think about, what are you building? What type of society do we want to live in? What's important? How do we get our needs met? And so those questions become critical in designing and co-creating a new space. And that's the important metaphor that Detroit represents.
Can you talk about what you're working on in Detroit right now? What are your current goals? What are your current projects?
Wow. So inside of East Michigan Environmental Action, we do a lot of youth leadership. So the mission of East Michigan Environmental Action Council is to empower the Detroit community to protect, preserve, and value the air, land, and water. And we do that through collaborative relationship building, through youth leadership, to environmental justice education, the policy making, and through a lot of critical awareness in community. So the current project is, we're doing a youth leadership and development program where we're training young people to be more engaged in projects and programs and youth leadership and organizing. So they're forming a cadre of people who can problem solve on their own behalf. We do a lot of partnering. EMIAC is part of a lot of collaboratives, a lot of tables, a lot of consortiums. And from that, we leverage consensus and group work. And ultimately, teams win, right? So it's not just to leverage your singular self, but to leverage many selves that becomes synergistic and empowering. The public policy piece is, we're advocating for equitable food and ag, for urban nature agenda, for water quality, air quality, for zero waste. We're advocating for energy resiliency and energy reduction. And we're advocating for climate and climate justice. Those are all our policy frames. And we work on the federal, state, and local level. and we track policy, we review policy, and we jump in the fights, and we jump into contested spaces to kind of promote the agency and voice of low-income communities of color in an environmental justice frame. And the environmental justice education, we take a whole lot of environmental justice tours. We show impacted communities. We kind of like talk about the way the communities are in resilience and problem solving on their own behalf, which, you know, even though we're environmental justice advocates, nothing takes the place of the standing agency and voice of community, nothing. And a community that's empowered and it's in their standing and agency and voice doesn't mean they're not impacted, but what it does is it promotes empowerment. It promotes leadership development, it promotes engagement, and also promotes the agency of people to be able to speak truth to power.
Can you talk about the importance of resilience in community organizing, please?
Wow, resiliency in community organizing is a frame inside of the climate justice alignment inside of the United States. So in organizing, there's oppositional organizing, right? A fight. Let's go march. Let's go protest. Let's go stand in front of the pipeline development. There's electoral organizing that's all around voting and voting rights and public policy pieces that impact broad groups of people. And then there's this visionary organizing that you'll see a lot of philosophers and people who are generally framing a narrative around a vision around community and organizing around that. The resiliency-based organizing is a frame of the climate justice alignment that's attempting to make communities into powerhouses of not only standing agency and voice, but co-creation and adaptation and locally rooted, centered economic drivers, so that it's kind of like, what do we have as assets in the communities? What are we leveraging? What's our relationship to each other? How do we build from that strength? And so resiliency has to come from the people, the orgs, and the place. And it's mainly set up to make communities more elastic in being confronted by economic challenges and climate challenges and social challenges. And it's a frame. It's like, we are the ones. We're connected. We're the actors. We're the agents. And what do we co-create? How do we move forward past these situations that increases and improve our power and our ability to bounce back from these shocks? And so at the heart of it is responding to shocks and responding to slides, these things that are happening incrementally over time, and shifting frames and shifting work to improve the quality of life of everyone.
So you've traveled a lot in your many, many, many capacities. And I was wondering, as a broader question, what do you think are some of the major differences in terms of perception of climate reality, as well as similarities, and as well as how communities are building around such issues?
There is a profound worldwide perception that climate and climate chaos and climate transitioning is happening. Particularly in Africa. So the climate alignment groups in Africa are very much impacted. Superstorms, flooding, erosion, pests, you know, scourges like descending like locusts. The ability for anybody around the world to be able to say something is happening, the people who are normally witnessing it first are the most marginalized members of society. So the first people was like, something is wrong, were indigenous peoples worldwide. They was like, wait a minute, something is wrong. And they were looking at species extinction. They were looking at collapse of biodiversity. They were looking at, you know, mining and logging and resource extraction. It was like, wait a minute, what's going on here? Why did stream dry up? Why are these trees are dying? What's going on? And so in traveling, what you see is the perpetual cry and voice of indigenous people saying, what are you doing? And what is causing this? And they might not could articulate what was causing it. until the academics and the climate scientists jumped in and was like, oh, it's climate, oh, sea level rise, or acidification, or your fisheries collapse because of overfishing, but really because of acidification and dead zones. And so what is really happening is we're just now catching up to the lived experience of indigenous people. For people in the north, the global north, and what we would call the west, but it's the global north, we have a duty to abate our emissions and our waste streams and everything so that indigenous peoples worldwide can live. The more we pollute, we think stuff is just going to the landfill. No, it's washing out in our tributaries and creating great, great mile upon mile of floating garbage in our oceans that affects fisheries. So we think, oh, we're just one little person, we're in our house, and impact is global. So a million people throwing away stuff is a million things floating. And we just see ourselves, but we need to think about the millions of ourselves and the billions of ourselves impacting this wonderful, beautiful planet that is our home. I don't think all of us can go to Mars and hang out on Mars or on the moon. So this becomes critical for us to think about a planetary like visioning of how we're impacting all of life. And so traveling affords you with a perspective that leaves your local community and seats you as a world citizen. And that's a wonderful perspective to have.
Like you said, we're 7 billion going on 8 billion people in the world. Mm-hmm. And there is a huge portion of the world, especially in the global south, that is increasing its standard of living, and with that comes increased consumption. So do you think that the global north will be able to decrease its overall consumption, and that the perception of what progress is in the global south won't lead them to consumption patterns that resemble the west's? And will we be able to do that on time in order to support 10 billion humans on one earth?
Wow. That's a lot of converging factors and a lot of unknown. Definitely the global north has some duties. I don't think we're, as people, like individuals inside of these societies, have reached a point of critical awareness. But I will put some critical awareness on the governments, who are the authorities on our consensus and on our sovereign states. To be, you know, you don't have, how many times do you meet at Copenhagen? How many times Warsaw? How many times Brazil? How many times do you sit in a conference of parties on climate and hear the data, see the impact, and sit quiet? So definitely the global north has to damper down, has to cool down, has to pump some brakes. And we can do it. We can transition our energy systems. We can look at the way we construct cities and societies to be more resilient and sustainable. We can reduce our waste streams so we're not polluting every place and everywhere. The global south, it's hard for me to tell people who have nothing or who are on the United Nations scale of development that you don't have a right to growth or economy or a burgeoning like. But if you're trying to model your economic order on the global north, you're in trouble. Because the conspicuous consumption, the resource drain, and the extractive technology that has fueled the global north cannot be transplanted and transmitted to the global south. We only have one earth, and we're already outstripping her with, you know, we need another earth to go pimp or another earth to go raid just on resources like water. Like, we're only dealing with 1% of water. Everything else is frozen, is underground, is unavailable to us, or we're polluting it. So we have to rethink how we show up as humans and how nation states operate. And to be able to do it in time, I have no idea. I personally think we're already in tipping points and runaway climate scenarios with the boreal forests and some ecosystems that might not be able to recover, and so they'll be in a new state. So we're going to have a new soil maps. We're going to have new climate and jet stream trajectories. We're going to have new spots that are going to be, you know, designated in new climate highs and lows. what our ability has to be is not, we don't know what end time is. So it's not like by this date, do this, and we have abated climate catastrophe. All of this is interdependent and dynamic. But if we don't start working now, we're in trouble. And that's what is critical, is who's working right now, who's abating, who's controlling emissions right now, who's on their way to controlling emissions in a year or two, who's thinking about ecosystems and environmental frames to help protect species from habitat loss and extinction. And all of that has to be done, not so much even in a coordinated way, but under critical awareness. And so that's what we're under. We're under a profound frame of what are we paying attention to? And where's the impact? And how do we do both and? How do we get the North to cool down and stop being so greedy and materialist? And get the South to say, okay, you guys get the economically development, but not at any and all costs. And definitely not at the cost of our life support system.
This is a two-part question. Can you talk a bit about some of the opposing forces that you experience in your work in Detroit? And then can you talk about why you mentioned to me a couple days ago the importance of tension in organizing, and can you elaborate on that and why tension might be necessary in carrying out solutions?
So a lot of forces that are normally in opposition to a human-centered, sustainable, vibrant, localized economy that's climate resilient has to do with a single bottom line approach to things. One is the market forces. Everything that's being commoditized is ascribed a value from every widget and wadget we make. And then the full cost of it is externalized to the environment to be serviced. So we're not paying the full cost of any of our goods and services, because if we had to pay the real cost, we wouldn't be able to pay. And so one of the major forces is being fully aware of the cost of how we're living. From a hamburger, what's the real cost of a hamburger? What's the real cost of a Nike shoe? What's the real cost of clothes? What's the real cost? Because there's pollution and waste streams, there's degraded labor standards, there's a lot of degradation in our current economy that we're not really paying for, and if we had to, we would be in trouble. Another force that's in opposition to the work is the popular culture's ability to oversimplify things that require some level of complexity, and then the things that need to be super simple, making them so hyper-complex that you don't know what people are talking about. So keeping simple things simple and complex things complex and showing the relationships of all of that is an opposing system. So I'm not talking people, but big corporate, big ag, things that are too big to fail, things that have gamed our democracy are forces of opposition. But also mind states and processes like consumerism. That is a problem. Like conspicuous consumption, like the whole rush to consume, have turned all of us into materialists. And we're not fully aware of consuming and throwing away, consuming and throwing away. And where is a way to throw away? Where's the way? So we don't like, what is the way? So with these waste streams that we've created and these toxicities that we've created, we're not fully aware of it. And so we need some level of people being critically aware of how they show up as a consumer and how they show up as a materialist. The other question of kind of like holding tension. Tension is not a form of... Our tendency is to be comfortable, right? We want to be warm. If it's too cold, we want to be warm. If it's too warm, we want to cool down. We turn on the air conditioning. And so every element of modern North American and even Northern world culture living is about our comfort, how our houses are constructed, how our sofas are situated. It's about comfort. We even sell cars on they're comfortable. like this is comfort, right? Because we want things easy and we want things like we want to be in luxury. But what we don't appreciate is the dynamic nature of tension, the tension between being comfortable and uncomfortable, which is a difference between being safe and unsafe. I'm not talking about safety and security. I'm talking about the critical awareness on how rushing towards comfort has allowed us to put on blinders and not see impact. And so holding tension is about being uncomfortable. And when you're uncomfortable, you're learning, you're growing. And any experience of discomfort is you pay attention to it, right? So when we rush towards comfort, we're rushing to ignoring things. We're taking stuff off the radar. We are blinded. But when you become uncomfortable, you're just like, wait a minute, I got to pay attention. I'm cold. Or this seat ain't feeling right. So we adjust ourselves. And so in discomfort and holding tension is always adjustment. And that is a form of shifting. And so when we begin to deal with our discomfort, we begin to learn how to shift and adjust and to reframe and to pay attention. And that's what we need. For social movements, it becomes critical because all over the world, we exploited hierarchy and racism. And we marginalize women, we marginalize youth, we marginalize people, vulnerable populations worldwide. It's not an island in the world or a large landmass that doesn't have race, class, and gender hierarchies on it, particularly if they were a colonial legacy state from Europe. Europe exploited hierarchy and racism, and it wasn't just through slavery and abusing African peoples, but they marginalized indigenous peoples, called them savages, called them lazy, and abused them. So holding tension is also a frame to be aware of privilege, power dynamics, who's being marginalized, who's at a table, who's not. And so people who hold tension are perpetually trying to figure out how to adjust, how to bring equity. Where is the justice at? So that's the frame in justice-based work is what tensions are we holding? Some of them you can't get rid of. Some of them, they're just on the table. So if you're at a table and it's all white folks, you're in trouble, particularly if the impact is with communities of color. You got to figure out, and not in a token way, find some person of color and bring them at the table, but how do you authentically hold the tension? You have no relationships with people of color. How do you go get some? How do you go make friends? So those are ways of attempting to adapt and adjust organizing injustice frames to shift.
So there's a pattern in what you say, where it's sort of like, you know, in nature the only constant is change, and we have to be elastic. And there's another pattern where in order to begin on this journey towards change, we need to have critical understanding. Is that the phrase? Very simply, how do we bring about critical understanding on a mass scale?
You can do that level of awareness under a mass scale by, one, modeling. Where are the models? And affirming and lifting up the models. So who's ever holding tension and who's ever critically aware, how are they operating? What are they saying? What are they doing? Modeling becomes important because we got these capacities to mimic. You might not understand everything, but we bandwagon jump. We go along and get along. If you see people lined up, you go jump in line. And then you ask somebody, why are you in line, right? So there's this ability for us to be congruent with each other. We want to fit in. We want to be like in the in crowd. So models become important for the dissemination of critical awareness. Another way is we have to start telling the stories of impacted people and communities. First Nations stories have to be told over and over again. And it's not just the lamentation and complaint, oh, I'm dying, or, oh, you abused me, but what's your understanding about the place? Tell me your myth. Tell me your values. Tell me your narrative. Because what that does is that recalibrates our understanding about the possibilities of being. See, right now we exist in these modern states as economic units. But we're also human beings. We're creatures. And so storytelling and narrative dissemination creates in us a psychological awareness of the possibility of being. I mean, we can dream some stuff, but when we start telling stories, we get caught up in fantasies and we get caught up in things. And they're much, and so the things we contemplate becomes the things that we also act upon. A third thing to create the shift in critical awareness is we got to call out false solutions. If you're doing a harebrained ideal, you're doing like, look, we know we're polluting. But what we're going to do is we're going to do some offsets. So if I'm a polluter, I'll pay some credits over here that allow me to pollute. Really? That's the solution? That market-driven analysis of cap and trade and carbon markets is a false solution. We have to begin to call out the false solutions that continue the problem or window dress it as non-substantive. And so critical awareness has to be calling out the false solution, getting us to contemplate a possibility of being, and looking at some models.
Who or what is your model of critical awareness?
Wow. I have a few. Wow. And I'm getting excited, but one of my wonderful models is Wangari Maathai, who is the late Wangari Maathai. And oftentimes I think about, what would Wangari do? And Wangari is kind of like, she has this wonderful wit and wisdom as a woman of African origin around trees. And it's not just a green belt movement, but it's her personality, how she sees nature as beautiful and creatures and all of created as kin. So as a motto, that's like, wow, Wangari, like, if I want to channel anyone, I want to channel Wangari as a model. She inspires me. Another person that gives me great, great, I guess, is my own father. He, as a country man, he taught me composting and planting, and he loved the environment. He fished, and he demonstrated care and concern over nature. It wasn't a preacher. He didn't like come with a blog and like, oh, read my blog. He lived it. So the example that I had as a child was a man who thought about squirrels. So he fed birds and squirrels, right? So I learned as a young child that animals were important. They were a part, you know, and I'm like, and I didn't understand later that they can just go on, like, they forage, right? I kept thinking, like, they're going to die if I don't feed them, right? So I had this weird view about birds and squirrels and animals, like, oh, I have to go get some breadcrumbs, right? Because I would see a bird and the bird would look at you, right? And I was like, baby, are you hungry? Like, you know? So it was this weird, it wasn't weird for me, but it was this interaction with animals and nature that afforded me to pay attention to them. So my father is my inspiration and model, too.
Going back to traveling, this is your first time in Montreal.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering if you could tell us a bit about your impressions of community organizing here in Montreal, and what have you learned from your visit, and, you know, what are you hoping to teach us while you're here?
Mm-hmm. One of the things that happened, I'm very happy and very much appreciative that I'm in Montreal. Martin, my colleague here, was in Detroit with me for a few weeks, and one of the things he brought back here was reflection. So in Detroit, what I'm hoping to implant is resiliency inside of organizers to protect them from burnout and fatigue, that we sit and we build relationships with each other that become critical for not only our work, but for social inclusion and social support. So we had a reflection, initial one here in Montreal, and it went so over the top well. I am just literally tingling at the possibilities of the cross-pollination and also holding tension around race and class and privilege here in Montreal that I think would make Montreal more healthier in the social movements frame, but also to help improve and increase human interaction and human dignity here. So definitely bringing some of the learned lessons from Detroit, resiliency, reflection, A little bit of design work. How do we co-create? Like, what do we do? What I've learned from Montreal is complex. I'm a little bit, you know, there's a love affair with Canada. We consider Canadians to be hyper and super friendly. But now being here, what I'm seeing is the tensions of Anglophone and Francophone divisions that have given me pause. I'm like, wow, check that fight. And then the charter issues. I'm like, wow, that hurts. And so what I'm learning about is Montreal has some wonderful people in it that are engaged in love and justice and resiliency and repair and restoration and honoring story and building, you know, diverse, sustainable human communities and agricultural systems. But I'm also seeing a great deal of fear and hatred and kind of like dislocation. That it's not the illumination of it that gives me pause. It's like, wow, it's the battle everywhere. It's the battles we're holding in the United States. It's the battles in Europe. It's the battles in Palestine. It's like, what will win, fear or love? The hatred, the racism, the cleavage, and the social dislocation in Montreal is everywhere. And matter of fact, if I didn't see it here, I would be scared. Think like, what is Quebec doing? What is Montreal doing? But what it does is it gives me a chance to see where I'm at in Detroit and my work a little bit clearer, and to appreciate in a comparative fashion the struggles of Quebec, the province, and Montreal in particular, to be relevant and rooted and real in community. So I'm a little bit stimulated by what Montreal organizers are learning. I'm a cheerleader. I hope to be a support. And I hope that Montreal grows in its capacity to shift some things towards love and social inclusion and not towards hatred and removal and marginalization.
Wow. Is there anything else you would like to add?
Well, I do have a pet project. I've been visualizing it. Normally in the States, we work on issues and issue-based organizing. And one of the things that's happening is it creates silos, like separations and fractures. And people hunker down and get inside of silos and do fantastic and magnificent work. They do. But the cross-pollination, I'm much more interested in cross-pollination. So as a permaculturist, I would love to stack some functions. And I'm trying to visioning a project called the Detroit Beloved Community Project, where the root is ecological and environmental restoration and resilience. It's environmental placemaking. So it would be rain breaks and bioswales and rain gardens and permeable, and like all of this ecological kind of niche making. And then the second sphere would be the retrofit of the built environment for more geothermal, more solar, more wind, more permeable surfaces, so that the built environment is not counter the ecological and environmental form. It works with it, or at least tilts towards net zero impact. The third sphere that I'm working on is social inclusion and social support, trying to think about creating for communities child care collaboratives and elder care collaboratives and ride shares and bike shares, and how do we tie people together in a layer of mutuality where not only do you share a geographical place, but you also share some social support. And then on top of that, the cherry on top of the sundae or the cake would be local governance. So that would inform some participatory budgeting, some decision making with a local governing council that can really develop the leadership and the standing and the agency of community to problem solve on their own behalf. Most of the time, we talk about the civic mind, like the civic mind and civic discourse. But in the United States, our civic mind is reduced to two things: voting and paying taxes. And that can't be the beginning and the ending of civic discourse and the civic mind. And so the local governance boards will help to restore and repatriate the consensus of groupthink, you know, and bring back the tension between public and private. So the Beloved Community Project is a project, hopefully, that's emergent, that's nested in stack functions that will help to develop profound resiliency and some social inclusion in an urban area that suffered from dislocation. And we call it root shock, where you are gentrified and you're priced out of areas, you got to move. And so in Detroit, we're under profound gentrification. It's overwhelming. A lot of speculators have rushed in and are purchasing land and property, and they're creating profound root shock. And what we need is a place-based, sustainable, vibrant urban planning system to restore people's sense of self and their place and their rooting and their social integration. So that's what I'm currently working on. I invite people to come visit us in Detroit. We are happy to receive visitors. Definitely, most people come and visit our Urban Act. But we also got wonderful, wonderful street and community-based art projects. We get music. We get all types of museums and kind of like something for everyone. But the real part of Detroit is intangible. It's the restoration of human networks and human interaction that is so important. It's hard to speak on it. If you come and see it, you'll be like, you'll have the aha moment. Nothing is critical than experiencing things rather than just analytically thinking about them. I wish great success on Montreal. I appreciate Montreal for the opportunity to be present. And also, I'm very much looking at tracking what comes out of this community as a model and as a climate leader. We need cities. We need people in cities to think about how they show up in the world. And so I'm expecting great things from Montreal and to see Montreal as, you know, a model. People are like, well, that's, look what Montreal just did, or look, so Montreal has a moment to kind of like think about its community as far north as it is and inside of a first world nation as Canada, to think about what's our model? What story are we telling the world? How do we build a regional, you know, food system? How do we do our energy? How do we think about climate and climate impact that mitigates the impact on low-income communities of color and First Nations and people of color? And how do we demonstrate and how do we turn ourselves into a model? And Montreal can do it. And so I would like to think that some people here will get together and start implementing some things, and we can bring people from Michigan and from the States to come see it and to learn a deeper understanding from what Montreal has to offer.
Just so that our listeners can find out more, how can we find out more about your work in Detroit? Do you have any websites that you can refer us to?
Wow. So the first website is emeac.org, www.emeac.org. It stands for East Michigan Environmental Action Council. The second website is the Detroit Food Justice Task Force, oneword.org. It is the place of this kind of moderate table of actors working in the agricultural and food system to create a lived food justice experience in Detroit. And after meeting JAM, I'm impressed. And I'm seeing all levels of like interaction between the Food Justice Task Force and JAM. The third is E4Health Partners, one word, .org, which is my personal policy website, where we're looking at equitable food and ag systems across the federal landscape that inform and improve the quality of life of low-income communities of color and impacted persons. So any of those websites, emeac.org, DetroitFoodJusticeTaskForce.org, and E4HealthPartners.org will send you to the work that we're holding in Detroit.
Charity,
Thank you.
Thank you so much for taking the time to meet with us today. Thank you so much for coming to Montreal. I feel like I have learned so much from you in the past couple of days. It's amazing. And Melissa, we should go to Detroit sometime.
Absolutely.